All right, so thank you for joining us. This is my literature and visual culture class, which is attached to, or I feel in my head, has always been attached to the Beyond the Black Panther exhibit. The class is kind of inspired by this question of Afrofuturism in comics. And as I indicated to you, you know, one of the things that I've sort of done with that exhibit is sort of like thought about African-American creators in the sort of classic definitional form, and, you know, made an analysis and said, well, this is very Afrofuturist. And your work was one of the works. I'm like, this is very Afrofuturist. That's one of the show. We're familiar with your work because I did have them read the Invention of E.J. Whitaker. I just speak a little bit about your previous comic, which I actually also think is a little Afrofuturist, but not quite as clearly Afrofuturist as Invention. So, you know, our class is really steep. We've really done a lot with the definition of Afrofuturism, and also done a lot with the definition around comics and so on and so forth. But, you know, I always think it's really important to ask creators, give some context to the path that got them to the place that they're at. It's always like to start off with like a sort of like basic question of like, kind of tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, how you came into the work that you're doing. Rest assured that the students do have questions. That's my look.
He gives the teacher eye to everybody in the Zoom. through the
Zoom. But, you know, I think it's super worthwhile to sort of like have creators sort of recount their origin story in Meet the Superhero. What's your origin story, Mona? So, you know, obviously you're twins, which, you know, I think it's actually kind of cool. So like a singing group, whenever I say like, Gibbs. but also you're clearly deep into the entertainment industry. And so that's also interesting. Last week we were joined by Tim Fielder, who's a Afrofuturist graphic artist.
Yes, amazing. And also a twin.
Also a twin, yeah.
Right, yeah, there's an unexpected high level of twindom. And, he is a twin. I'm gonna have to look into that.
There's something there.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you came to be the Magnus and Gibb sisters? Like, you know, how did you become who you are?
Yeah, well, we're currently in Los Angeles working in entertainment and comics. And I'll let Shanae, I love how Shanae tells our origin story. But we're in Los Angeles, but we're from Oakland. So we're from the Bay Area, born and raised, and that is where it all started.
Yeah, and it's funny that the exhibition is called, I mean,
uh-oh. I think you're breaking up a little bit, Shanae. Oh, we probably both went. All right, am I here?
Yeah, you're still here.
Oh, okay.
Damn Zoom. Somebody's
can you see her? Oh yeah, somebody's like pranking us. This is, yeah, we never had at this bad of some technical connection. Let's see, I'm on. If it really gets bad. We're in separate spaces, but we're in separate spaces in the same house.
Oh, right.
So we might, you know, we might just have to come. If I continue to still be able to make it through, we could come. She could come in here.
Is she like the next room? Keep being like, you drop me. You drop me.
Right. She's probably still telling the story. Hold on just a second. Stand by. This is comedy. We love comedy as well, everybody. Oh, how much time do we have? I'm sorry.
We're doing this from 1 to 2.
Huh?
We have to, from 1 to 2.
Okay, so yeah, we'll try to make this. Let me get it together. Technical issues. Just a second. Oh.
Yeah, see? Curse Twitter.
We'll just make that a fade out. And we're making a transition. This is the
scene
change, yeah. Do you have a chair? And then we'll try to make sure that we have, am I frozen now?
Your camera, can you hear me? Seem to be on. Is your camera on?
I look frozen. Is the camera on? But you can hear me.
Oh, they are.
Okay. Ow, yeah. There they are.
Take your earbuds.
Okay, and now you are quiet. We can see you, but now we can't hear you. It's like, okay.
Yeah, just going back to our origin story, and growing up, we grew up in Oakland, California. And the thing about Oakland is that it is the home of the Black Panther Party, which was a movement of the 60s and 70s. And Oakland was sort of our... it shaped us, you know, and in terms of people who come from Oakland, you know, there was, when we were growing up in the 80s and 90s, there's like, in terms of the hip hop movement, there's MC Hammer, who's like a huge star in the 80s and 90s, there's Too Short, and then Tupac got his start in the Bay Area as a part of Digital Underground. And so there was just a movement of arts and entertainment and a sense of pride in being African-American and just seeing our town and ourselves just reflected in the mainstream. And I just think growing up in a culture, you know, and a culture in the Bay Area where our mom, you know, came out of the 70s and people were, African-Americans were super empowered. And you see that reflected in the names of, you know, children. There's like Jamila's, Jamal, you get Shanae and Chanel, you know, people are really excited about reclaiming our identity and naming ourselves and all of that stuff. And it was just super progressive. It was a super progressive town to grow up in. And that was where we were nurtured and where we played and we developed our sense of self in a comfortable sort of space. So we never, growing up in Oakland, I don't think I personally in my youth, like in elementary formative years, ever felt other. You know what I mean? There was just so much, even in the educational system, teachers, administrators, everybody was diverse and
they poured into us.
Yeah, they poured into us. Chanel, yeah. Jump in there.
No. Yeah.
So yeah, they really poured into us and whether we were, I mean, we grew up going to church. And so there were many places for us to find our voice. So even if we were singing, you said the Gibb sisters, Chanel did the doo-wop, but like we would sing, we would make up songs, we would write stories. Our mother was an artist and she taught us how to draw. And Chanel was just recounting a story where she and her mom, like growing up, she just remembers our mom doodling with her at church. And so as the preacher's preaching, just to keep Chanel sort of like entertained.
Yeah, she was like elevating my drawing. So she taught us how to see ourselves and portray ourselves, you know, through drawing. And I like to say that our mom was kind of like a secret artist because over the years, she kind of just like tucked it away. And I'd never understood that until now, actually, because, you know, life, you know, and I think that's why it's so important. And she wanted us to, she really wanted us to embrace, you know, that side of ourselves and carry it further than she did, you know? And I feel like we kind of stopped at a certain point actually drawing. That was our way of communicating too. It was our way of communicating in the home and outside of the home. And then we realized that people actually responded to like our art and our stories and the collaboration of things. Even just like, I mean, Oakland was just so good for us, like growing up. I mean, I feel like early on we were a part of so many things, like the Oakland, the Oratorical Fest, which was this, you know, we recited, you know, Maya Angelou and Langston Hughes, and like, you know, we were just infused and steeped in our culture and our heritage and our art, you know? So that was really kind of the beginning. And we learned how to tell our stories. Our mom, you know, taught us how to color ourselves, you know, to draw our noses and color our skin, and was adamant about making sure that when we drew ourselves or presented ourselves, you know, it was often, it was us, you know, we weren't, I mean, even though we sort of mimicked some of the stuff in the Sunday comics, or, you know, what that was around, or that could, because that was in the actual world, that was in the external world. But so yeah, we were able to have an internal world that was like our safe place.
Yeah, you know? And can I just want to piggyback on the idea of our mom teaching us to like draw ourselves and color, use the brown crayon. I just remember there was one time, I think it was, I must've been about 7 years old or so. And we were, our mom was also a preschool teacher when we were growing up. And I was coloring Santa. And I was coloring him like pink, or, you know, and my mom stepped in and she was like, hey, you know, you can use brown. And I was like, Santa's not, as I'm telling my mom, like, Santa's not black. And then she was like, basically, why can't he be? And that was at 7 years old, I'm like, oh, my mind is blown. Oh, like Santa can be black, you know? And I think, our mom and everybody of her generation was aware of the that doll test that was done with Black students in the 50s, where Black students were given a Black doll and a white doll to play with. And overwhelmingly, all of these little Black kids thought that the white doll was prettier and, you know, smarter and all of this stuff. And they preferred playing with that doll because what they knew of themselves was something that wasn't accepted and they didn't consider beautiful or, you know, worthy. So, coming out of that with all of that awareness and growing up in Oakland, and our mom just sort of like helping to shepherd our perspective and shape it early. So we didn't like, I didn't have to be 25, like, oh, Santa can be black. Not that that would happen, I mean, that but would, you know yeah. what I mean. So we just had, you know, we were just nurtured in loving ourselves. We were nurtured and loved, you know,
And supported. Yeah. And they like, they believed in us and they wanted us to believe in ourselves. And I feel like we got that very early on. Then in middle school, it kind of went little bit, because, you know, our mom advocated to get us into this school that was a more wealthy, affluent. It kind of went away, but what I did realize was that by the time we got to high school, and I'm sorry, this is going to take like 5 hours. Julian, are we still here?
Yeah,
you're still here. Okay, great. Okay, so, so anyway, we had a little, you know, moment where we had to come into the external world as different, as a little more different, as a little more other, you know, because, where we came from in Oakland and our beginnings were just a little humbler, you know, and we grew up with a single mom. And so we came into this this environment in middle school where, you know, there's like the flatlands in Oakland and the hills. And I say heels, whatever, but, and then, so, you know, we had a different encounter, let's just say that. And then, but we survived. And one thing that I realized too, was that, and this started in middle school, was that, writing and creative writing, like, was my weapon.
you know? And then by the time we got to high school, Shania, you can stop me if I'm going too far, but that was like, you know, in the scene of the movie of your life where you choose your weapon, you know? It is like, you know, I pulled it out and I was like, okay, it's the pen and it's powerful. And like anytime, like I was, Shanae was always a model student. I mean, she was, and I would kind of be, you know, bumpy along the way here and there, but I knew anytime I had to write a paper, I could write my way out of anything, you know, at any time. And I just started realizing that. And then even when we got to like middle school or in these environments where we were the other and supposed to be, I guess, you know, the lesser, you know, it was just like, I just wheeled my little pen and it was our language. And it was like my way of communicating, like even when I couldn't articulate myself, you know, there were times when, you know, you might be angry about certain, you know, certain things or whatever. But I put it into, you know, writing and it came out perfectly. And so that power was just something that, that we were able to not only find and identify, but to build on and to grow. We were editors on the school newspaper
in high school.
Mm-hmm. And like to find flow, you know, with others. We'd be there all night. They'd start the game on Friday. you know, on the football field or whatever. And we were there till like 3 a.m. working, just losing track of time, yeah. Writing stories. And we would even, you know, our illustrations were featured in the Oakland Technical Scribe newspaper. So Oakland Technical High School is where we were at.
And, we just sort of found that that writing and creativity was, it was our voice and we honed it. Mm-hmm. And just like Chanel said, losing track. I mean, when we're in the flow of creating projects, it's like you lose track of time. And it's almost like that's how you know you're doing something that you're really passionate about. I think particularly when you're younger, it's good to cultivate something that excites you, mm-hmm. you know, like something you can always come back to. We discussed this a little bit, but when you're trying to find yourself, like, and when we were in college and afterwards and, you know, you go to the clubs and all of that stuff. And that sustains you for us, it might sustain some of you guys a little more. But it was like, yeah, I could have a good time or whatever. But when I come home, I just like, I have to create, like, I need to get that passion going. And even in, you know, pandemic times, like it's having these little things to help you find your peace and, you know, find your place and express yourself. I mean, it's always a good thing.
It's there. I mean, like, I feel like it's been there. It's carried us through so many things, you know, joyous times, grief and tragedy. And, you know, even through work, like we got to LA and I'm skipping a bunch of stuff or whatever, and we can come back if you want to. But we were doing a bunch of youth media in the Bay Area, which I love the Bay Area so much. We came down here and it was like a desert. Like when we were out of college, I was at ZM, Arts and Technology Museum, in the education department. You know, we had come through Oakland Unified School District, just like creating. We were working with at-risk students, but like in the midst of that, creating programs, and we created like a video production program, and we would drag our, I forget what the old desktop,
the G4
to DP Stokeland, and just like we had like a Canon, a good prosumer sort of, like, we spent a lot of money on, just give it to the kids, teach them how to do stuff. So we were just like improvising programs before we actually got into formal, formal education of like youth media and stuff, which was actually, I think about it, it's funny. But so I was in San Francisco at the ZM Arts and Technology Museum, which has changed to another name. But yeah, we were doing all sorts of claymation and different digital workshops. I did was it was like a spoken word sort of digital workshop, just coming up with curriculum for different stuff and engaging and allowing or encouraging kids to use their creativity and words and art and visual arts and stuff. And then when we left the Bay Area and came to LA, there was like, we were trying to find jobs doing what we do. Shanae, you were with Youth Sounds in Oakland doing, you know, similar work. We were doing animation programs. Yeah. We were doing, we did a partnership with San Francisco State, which is our alma mater. We did a partnership with them and Girl Scouts. Girls Go Tech was the name of the program. So much stuff is coming. It just feels like we've lived so many lifetimes. But like, we did an animation and a video workshop, and the stuff that those girls did was just like incredible over a summer. So yeah, by the time when we got to LA, there was no youth media. And we were thinking we were just come down here and just do what we were doing. And then, so we hit a wall in that or whatever, and then just ended up having to find, I mean, not that we weren't interested in entertainment, but it kind of was more like we just couldn't do what we did naturally. Yeah. And then, so we got, you know, into television jobs, entry-level sorts of things. And that takes all of your time. That was a thing. Like we were, you know, you'd be working 12-hour days and or, you know, just very long hours, especially production, even in post-production. And so a lot of our time was just being consumed by work. But we were just trying to you know, we would make room to just like carve out little bits of pieces and stuff. And we were working on Adopted by Aliens.
Yeah.
When we
And speaking of superhero origin stories, I mean, I will take just a couple of steps back and talk about, like, once we found our voice in high school, we also found Octavia Butler. And we have
differing.
Yeah, but
versions of how it came to be.
Yeah, but Chanel found
Kindred.
And it was that 1979 cover where there's a Black woman who was, you see her in the past and you see her in the present, and the present was 1970s, and there's an hourglass in between. And we saw that cover and we were like, what is this? Like,
there was a golden light involved in the one version, because I feel like I found her in Miss Pyatt's class. And they said she was found at the Berkeley Public Library. But wherever I saw it, it was like a light from above just came down, just shone on the book, and my hand reaches out slowly, like little gold specks, kind of, you know? And yeah, it was like,
yeah. And so when we found her, and this is at the time where we're finding our voices, writers, it was just like, here's a Black woman working, carving out a voice in science fiction, and describing herself as a hermit.
Right.
I mean, it was almost like she owned being a solitary sort of writer, you know, or somebody who was an outcast and an introvert. And so it gave, like, if you're a shy sort of person, like when I was growing up, I think I was shyer. Chanel was, you know, she's going to say she wasn't, but
I mean, we were both introverted.
Yeah. So to find that she was just like, she was a goddess. It was like, this is the woman, she's living a life, as a professional writer, telling stories that just excites us. And we just we went to Kindred and we were like, what else does she have? And we just consumed everything that Octavia Butler had. And then we found Octavia Butler, went to San Francisco State for college. School of Cinema. And we were always writers and artists. And we started combining writing and art. And we were doing a lot of animation. So we're doing independent animation. We did this project called Ravishing Raspberry, which it was like mixed media. It was crazy. It got us a lot of attention. We did Adopted by Aliens, which is a story of, and we animated all of this stuff ourselves, drew and animated, and directed and stuff. And it was a story of a young girl who's 12 years old who lives in the foster care system, which a lot of the children we were working with were in, you know, they had non-traditional families like
us.
We, you know, I think Jay-Z had lyric, or is this like half orphan? You know, we felt sort of half orphan, and a lot of our stories explore themes of protagonists who come from families that are not traditional families. And you'll also find that in The Invention of E.J. Whittaker. We're animating stories about Black girls flying in spaceships. This is like 2004. And all of that, we're doing all of this in this as we're coming to Los Angeles. So we took, our animation was kind of bubbling, you know? And this is funny because now, maybe almost, this is like 15 years later, there's like a big discussion of animation and African Americans. But this conversation, I mean, it was, the seeds were planted. It was sort of happening back around 2004, where there was like a bit of a small explosion of Black people exploring animation online. There was Urban Entertainment. There was the Love Brothers, who were still doing comics. Yeah, we adored them. We were like, I don't know where they are, but mm-hmm. we're just like, you know, they inspired us so much. Mm-hmm. So we ended up taking a meeting with a big animation studio. I won't even say what name it was, but they're big and everybody's watched them and stuff. And we had a meeting with an exec over there, and they heard about Adopted by Aliens, and they reached out to us. And he was just sort of like, you know, the kind of content we're making is for white boys who are like 12 years old. And, you know, essentially it was just sort of like, what am I supposed to do with you guys?
Yeah, which we had also heard before. In an African-American, it was a commercial agency back home.
Yeah, there was an advertising agency, a huge agency, actually.
They specialize in African-American and Latino content.
Yeah, and they still are doing super well in the Bay Area, but a woman saw our film, our Ravishing Raspberry film, and she worked at the agency. She's like, you guys got to come in here. I want to get you into this, you know, agency. You guys should be here. So we meet with this guy. I don't remember his name. He was stuffy. He was a little pretentious, you know, and he's just like, we're just kids. This is like our first big interview. And we're like, oh my God, we adored the company. We're like, so we're seeing all these cool Black people working in Photoshop and all. We were like, this is our space. We found our home. Right. This is in Oakland. And we're like, oh, I'm envisioning myself working in a corner office somewhere with somebody, right? And so this guy says,
or even just in the Beehive,
whatever. You know, I'm just getting coffee for people. I didn't care. I wanted to be here. So this was like the dream revealed, and we're just fresh out of college, go in there, and this guy, he's like, you know, what do you guys? And he just kind of grilled us and really made us feel like sort of terrible.
Because at the time, I guess they were looking for pitches for a
masculine campaign. Yeah. Like, so what do you know about football and beer and all of this stuff? And he's like, then he literally said, what am I supposed to do with you guys? And we were like, just sort of crushed. And we just sort of picked ourselves up and went on or whatever. So there was this, at that time, it's like being, you know, women of color creators, creating animated content. We're talking Black girls in spaceships, like all sorts of stuff going on. Nobody knew what to do with us. They still don't know what to do. And that's fine because, you know, whatever, we don't care whether anybody, we know what to do with ourselves. So all of this is going on. So we transitioned to Los Angeles and to work in entertainment. We ended up finding jobs in television and became television producers, working in nonfiction, in the nonfiction space. But speaking of like superhero existences, at night, you know, and early in the mornings, you know, that is where we put our capes on and we were able to like really unleash and tell the stories that we wanted to tell. So
We held on to that.
Yeah,
it was something that we actually still do.
Yeah, so the cool thing about working in television, and we were story producing, so we're like telling stories, it helped to inform even our storytelling for comics. So when you're working in television, particularly when we were working, you kind of want to
build
audience's interest to the act out, so to that the commercial break. Yeah. You know, you're like, what's going to happen next? So as a producer, you know, you're just sort of shaping those stories and getting that person on the edge of their seat, you know, and wanting to come back after break. And then in comics, you are keeping the interest of your reader, and you're wanting them to get to that last panel, and you want them to turn it. You know, you just want them to keep turning, like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? So television was an awesome medium for us because it, for one, it was consistent paychecks, which is, as an artist, you need that. I mean, no, I think there's some, a lot of people, there's like some romanticizing the starving artist, which is cool. You can starve for like a couple of months or whatever, but you don't want that to be your entire career, because if you're busy worried about how you're going to eat, you know, it's hard to do the work. So television kept us afloat. And at the same time, we were able to carve out spaces to tell our comic book stories. And we've partnered with women like women in comics organizations like Ladies Night, Graham Cracker Comics. We were in a bunch of their anthologies. So we were able to partner with female editors. So it's like an all-girl band. It's like female writers, creators, and just, I mean, working with them was amazing. I mean, and I think it prepared us because you're working, everybody's working on deadlines. You're working for free, you know, but we're working with a shared effort of just creating something amazing for, you know, women in comics, and something special for readers of all genders.
I really appreciate that really detailed origin story. But I want to recognize that for the students who just read The Avenger E.J. Whitaker, I think it's a really innovative story, and I'm hoping that opportunity to sort of ask you about some of the choices you made in the story.
Sure.
Will engage them. So I'm going to throw the floor open. Just unmute yourself, say who you are, and ask the creators about the work. So who's going to go first?
I had a question.
Okay.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi. I was just kind of curious about like how you guys decided to like
tell your name.
I'm Alexia. I was just kind of curious about how you guys decided to like collaborate together on the project, and like how you went about like, I don't know, with like my sister, I like butt heads with her and have like our ideas. So like, I don't know, like how you guys went about like creating a whole project together, and like if there was ever any time where there was like turmoil, or if you guys like really disagreed on things, or like kind of like, did you split things up? I was more curious about like that whole portion of it.
Oh yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, it's taken time, you know, like any sister relationship. I mean, it started rocking. I mean, as kids, we would always like, you know, bicker back and forth and stuff. But when we first started trying to write, we initially, before we came to LA, we would kind of write together. And then we tried to do it when we got to LA and like sit at one computer and like write together. And I was like, somebody's gonna die. Like, we have to like split this up. We can't, you know, we can't continue to do it this way, just because like there are, you know, she had some ideas for dialogue and I would have, you know, ideas, and then we'd just get stuck, and then we'd have a stare down, and then we just were not like moving forward on the page.
And then it's just when you're working together, it's like if somebody's typing, it's like there should be a period there, and we should just say the instead of that, right, or whatever. It's like, oh my God, this is going to be forever trying to get this thing done.
So we started, we learned to outline, pretty much together. We would beat the story out together, and then split up and take the story in sections. So she would write sections, I would write sections, and then when we combined everything together, then we would just go through and punch up the, you know, that was my opportunity to, you know, contribute to her sections, and then the same thing.
Yeah, so, and we work like that now. So like, I'll take a scene, Chanel will take the scene right after, I'll take the next scene, so that it feels continuous and everybody gets a chance to get their voice in there. Mm-hmm. But that's really worked for us. And then just being able to work at separate locations and just sort of check off our list on the outline, it's been great.
And then it's continued even into, because our writing has a transition from doing comics writing. We did our animation writing together. We did a graphic novel together for Versify HMH. And now we're working in animation writing together. And so that same thing kind of is just it's just the basis, and it really works. And I was going to say, even when we contribute like in staff writing, so we're like in the writer's room of different rooms and stuff. It's funny because you think that we're twins. I mean, you know, we don't really, you know, some days we look more alike than others or whatever, but you would think that we would have similar pitches and ideas for stuff, and we don't. It's like, you know, line by line, like Shanae will be coming up with like something completely different. And I'm like, that's really cool. Cause my concern is always like, we'll just have the same pitch and the same idea and the same joke and people will be, but it's completely different. And I think that's what's helps us with our storytelling.
Yeah.
Oh, and I think, yeah. That's good. That's great.
Yeah, thank you.
And we compliment each other. That's the other thing. It's like to know each other's strengths. Like I think Chanel's great with the flowery language. I might be good with like technical stuff. So we just sort of compliment each other, which has been good.
That's great. Thank you. Next question.
I have a quick question. Kind of, I'm Ashley. Going off of what you guys just said, how, like, do you guys talk about like the storyline before you split up the scenes? Cause how do you like, when you get back together, how's it like, okay, whoa, this completely switched the narrative that I was doing. How do you guys make it flow better if you split up the scenes?
Well, and also like before we start a project, and we've been getting better at this too, is that we we build the world and the characters together too. So that with like Ada and William and Samuel and even the little automaton, Jesse, they have their own sort of perspective on the world and stuff. So so we have that in place too. And then we talk about the stories a lot before we even start, outlining, but the outlining is like really technical. I just don't really know how people, there are writers out there who will just sit down and start writing and then scenes will just pour out. I mean, and then they just have it. And then eventually they have a book. I don't know how they do that. I mean, because I need like planning. I need to know where everything is going. Shanae is the same way.
The outline is it's a roadmap. So it's like, you can never get lost. So we kind of have it point, like the pinpoints of the arcs, even if Chanel takes something, it's all sort of designed to flow together. So it's just a great map.
Yeah. And it's literally like, so we have it starts with an outline that's just kind of typed out. It sounds so technical or whatever, but then it goes into an outline that is numbered. Mm. It's like a numbered outline for all the scenes, of a screenplay or a graphic novel or a comic book or anything. It's like all the scenes are divided up that way. We can even, we know nobody ever takes on too much. Mm. You know what I mean? So it's just like, and then like you take this chunk and I'll take this chunk and then we'll put them together. And then that's how it sort of comes together. But even if the story sort of expands or something different happens, we add it to the out, like you have to put it in the outline before you get to, you know, write it or whatever. You can't just go off on go rogue. Or else we're gonna get beat up. No, I'm just joking. So yeah, it's like arm wrestling contest. It's just like nobody, you know, and we, you know, there are times when we have to have a discussion about like, would this happen, or like, you know, if this scene needs to be added or if this thing needs to be done. And then we never really have any like real issues, because it's like whoever's the most passionate about that, you know, like if you can really, it's almost, it becomes a courtroom. You know, it's like you plead, you know, everybody case, comes up the case, you present everything, and it's like whoever's more passionate, I'll just be like, okay, I'm done, okay, that makes sense to me, and then we just move forward. It's just like it's real, like I don't know, it works. It's democratic the way we do it too.
Very democratic.
Can you say a little bit more about So I want to say that you just said that you create a Bible for every comic book. And I'm like, that can't exactly be right. But like the story world that you create, because like every character has a backstory. Is that what?
No, well, every major character has a, and we, I mean, and it's evolving, you know? It's not like, well, one project we just worked on, I mean, I don't even know how this happened, but there for the two main characters, there are like 10 pages of backstory for each of them.
Yeah, the more so the
but we didn't do that. It wasn't that drawn out on the invention of EJ Whitaker, but every character has a little like we have to set up like, you know, who they are and what they are before we get started. So they do have a backstory. It's not like 10 pages, but
yeah, and I think the more we get into our craft of writing, like the deeper those the character backstory becomes. So it's like we've been asked on a project we're currently working on. We're asking questions. It's almost like the character is speaking to you and revealing themselves to you. So it's like the more you know about the character, the easier it is to write them. But for the invention of EJ Whitaker, we did a backstory sort of questionnaire about what the characters are, what their goals are, and then we had our outline for each book. So not a full like, but it's not as crazy as that, Julian. But it's we outline each story for each book, so we just know where we're going, and we leave room for flexibility as we create.
Yeah, because when we're writing too, we're also like it's like I can only describe it as like a channeling. You know, it's like the characters are saying, you know, and you'll laugh, you know, in the process of like, oh, yeah, this is totally like so and so, you know, as you're writing or whatever. Or like we got stuck one time with the graphic novel, too. And the one of the protags just like started. I just asked a question and he started talking to me. You know what I mean? And it's weird because even, you know, we're kind of with the invention of EJ Whitaker. There's like almost a century. No, there is more than a century between us. You know what I mean? And it's almost like they're channeling through you. Jessie, even some of the stuff that she does. I mean, she doesn't, she's not verbal. She doesn't speak, you know, English, but she'll tell you, you know, no, this is not, you know, this is not right or whatever. And that'll come out on the page. Or like William, I mean, I don't know. He's channeling through, you know what I mean? And it's funny. I mean, like they speak to you in different ways. So what we try to do before we start on a story is just have a good solid plan and then move forward from there. And then, you know, from there, it's not so rigid as like, you know, it has to exactly end here. Like, you know, this scene has to be this amount of length or whatever. But then it's just like, we get the roadmap and then we just channel. They just channel through us.
Thank you. question.
Hi.
Hi.
My name's Deira Lucas, and my question for you too is what do you recommend for young people and students that are passionate about visual arts? Like, how do you recommend that they utilize their resources so that they can become more creative and really expand their creativity?
I would say, that's a really good question, and I would say, give yourself time to do whatever that thing is that you do. So if it's art, give yourself some space throughout the day or just to create in your way. Like I know some people like rush to like get feedback or whatever, which is good. Feedback is good, but it's like, who is it? Malcolm Gladwell, who has the theory of putting in 10,000 hours on your craft to get good and to really be great. So I would recommend just giving yourself time and space to develop your passion. And then finding those influences or mentors to inspire you. For us, it was Octavia Butler and Tanana Reeve Dew, and I mean all sorts of people. But it's like the great thing that you guys have, like with Twitter and all this stuff, is that you can reach out to people and be like, hey, I'm doing this sort of thing. How you know, what would you recommend or whatever? And you can see their trajectory, you know, and see how they move to get things done. And that can inspire ideas for how you can do similar things. So I would recommend that, Chanel.
And yeah, that's really good advice, Nate. And then also too, just you can allow yourself to be inspired by all that is around you, you know. As we tell stories more and more, once we get distance from the stories, you know, you can see, oh, this was inspired by, you know, working with the kids in East Oakland, or this was inspired by that road trip that we took, or this was inspired by our grandmother. Just comes up so much in our work. We did a tribute to her, an animation called Old Ladies Driving. The name of the automaton, Jesse, and the invention of E.J. Whitaker is our grandmother's name. You know what I mean? It just is like, it comes to you. Even just watching birds fly around during the pandemic, I'm like an amateur bird watcher with like no like real tools, but just like sitting and watching nature has inspired something, that a project that we're going to work on. So I would say, do not be afraid to look around, you know, even just getting quiet and taking in your environment. The other thing is peers, you know, finding peers to not only workshop your ideas. Like we over the years, we've been a part of so many writers groups. They help us to encourage each other. You know, we encourage each other. So if it's an art group, any sort of group among your peers, socialist. Oh my God, yeah. It's so good. A writer friend that we work with, we just like, we all got this job together. You know what I mean? And we started like literally like a week after we came to LA together. And it's taken us this time to do this work or whatever, but along the way, we've been supporting each other so much and like making each other better. I think that peer groups are really important.
Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you.
Next.
I'll ask a question. My name's Lori.
Hey, Lori.
Hi. I'm also a student. And so I was just curious, I've never really worked on a project with my twin, and I was wondering, if do you think like having like that like twin, like I don't know, telepathy, people say, like sparks like creativity within you, or and like makes you want to like be better, like, and be competitive? So I was just wondering, and like, do you think it's a good idea to like try and work with your twin on stuff, like I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, yeah. So I guess we've been working together for forever, for so long, you know, and it's a natural thing to do. And I think with Chanel, we just sort of, what we were speaking to earlier, like we know each other's strengths and weaknesses, and then, if you and your twin are interested in collaborating, I think it's great, because one thing, having my sister in this business, or having like somebody who I can trust at all times, like we can argue and we never like fall out, you know what I mean? And
that's been that way for a long
time. Yeah, and then the other thing is like this is a support system, you know what I mean? Like I have a support system, and I have somebody who gets like creativity. So like she understands like if I need some time to like work on a something that I'm writing, and she's great. She gives me great advice. I gotta come in and just give her a hug. But she's just great. We just lift each other up. And yeah. I feel so blessed to have my sister to be like a partner and and supportive through everything. I mean, we've gone through a lot of stuff, like with family stuff, but then also having somebody that I know I can trust. So So it's like, if I'm like, Chanel, we got to work, get this script, you know, you got to write your portion, whatever. Like, I mean, even if we're feeling like everybody always, you know, you get writer's block and stuff, but I know that she's going to come through. Like, this is a lady who has honed and sharpened all of her stuff, and I trust her abilities and stuff. So to just have that sort of support, and I know where she lives. You know what I mean? Like, if you, I got to come and be like, get right. on this. You know what I mean? But it's just been really, I think this has been great. It's been great for me to have my sister.
And it's been equally great for me too. I mean, I just think where we grew up, for some reason there were a lot of twins. Mm. And this was even before, before twins were like in vogue. I don't know. Mm. It was like a lot of sweet potatoes out, something in the water. Because we had a lot of twins at our school back in the day. And but there were twins in our school who just like, or that we knew of, that just, they didn't get along. They just did not like each other. And we had one girl in particular we went to school with who, when they would get on the bus, one would sit on the front, in the front, and the other one would sit in the back. And they were like, and she was like the bridge between the two of them, because they hated each other. I don't even know what that was all about. But they would never even think to work together. But I think, you know, with Shanae, like, we've been helping each other out so long. And for some reason we found this language that is, you know, really works, you know, early on. It was like, first they were taking us apart. It took us so long to learn how to speak as kids, because we had this own little, our own little twin language that they were like, oh no, you know, you got to break that up or they'll never talk or whatever. So then it turned into drawing and creating together. And then even coming to LA, like, we would help each other out with all of our friends too, with jobs and stuff and like support. It's been great, you know? And I would say if your sister is like into it and you guys have some projects that you want to get started together, the sky is like the limit on that. So I'm all for it. We're like twin power over here. Yeah. So thank you for that question.
I do want to ask you a little bit about your planning process for something like the invention of EJ. That's as we talked about in class on Monday, very historically specific work. And again, you know, as someone who studies the past and also have a future, I'm like, well, this is actually a really powerful choice in terms of like a setting. You know, I talked a little bit about Booker T. Washington and a kind of Black nationalist paradigm, and there's a lot of complexity there. And hearing you talk about your work and your work with girls and youth media and things like that, it actually makes even more sense. But, you know, the work that I was familiar with before, it was like Fashion Forward. Which I point out to the students is about like a time traveling pair of shoes, basically, which is kind of Afrofuturist. All right, I mean, there's an argument there, but I'm like, it would have just more Afrofuturist. Just to be clear, but the fact that stuff, and I, if you know, so why Tuskegee? Was it a question of, oh, we want to do a you know. Again, a genre, this is a genre trope, like super intelligent scientist girl is super intelligent science is a trope. They're almost never Black, they're almost never female, right? So like, it makes a lot of sense to be like, oh yeah, we're gonna do a Black female scientist, like who has a robot and all this other thing. Very steampunk, right? But where to put it, so like, there's gotta be some choices that are driving that story idea, that story world idea. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that.
So I think the national, I mean, your definition, Chanel's definition of Afrofuturism is the African experience unlimited by time and space, you know, so.
Stories unbound.
Yeah, so we're just unbound. It's like forward, backwards. I love history. And even now, like exploring the past is really important to our future and our present. because I mean, now I'm going to sound, I don't even know what, who knows, but there's a Vietnamese monk who talks about when people sort of think that you come into existence at the time of conception, but if you really think about it, you exist before then because you exist in your parents as like the egg and all of that stuff. Yeah. And then if you go further back, you existed in your grandparents and you keep going back and we kind of like existed from the beginning of, we're kind of always here, you know what I mean? And so when you see me, when you see us, and when I look at you and I look at all of the students, we are, there are echoes of the past in us, you know what I mean? You see us, you're seeing a little Octavia Butler, that's Octavia Butler DNA, you
She's
know,
in our story DNA.
Yeah, you're seeing like hip hop, you know what I mean? You're seeing some Lauryn Hill, you're seeing some Maya Angelou, you're seeing all some of that outcast stuff. Yeah. And then, so at the same time that we were working on Fashion Forward, where we're envisioning this comic book of a time traveler who's using stiletto boots to, you know, try to get her advance in the world of fashion. This is just a super fun project for us. But we're envisioning, at the same time we were envisioning a future in New York, like 25 years into the future, we were also researching an African-American performer named Princess Wiwi, who she was a star of the Barnum and Bailey show. We wrote a screenplay about her life. And she's just the, you know, she's a little person, and she was a princess. I mean, she was a star, and this was like in the early 1900s, 1910s, into the 1920s. She would later tour with the Whitman sisters. So we were like doing research and we're finding out like, oh my God, like how cool was, there was so much cool stuff happening that we didn't, at the turn of the century, that we didn't even know so many cool people who existed.
And Shanae says a lot, you used to say that, you know, it seemed like the African-American experience was relegated to, you know, if it wasn't slavery in stories, it was the civil rights era and nothing else, you know, for a lot of the storytelling or whatever. And there's this period, you know, this time period, we're talking Booker T. Washington, we're talking W.E.B. Du Bois, we're talking about, you know, thought and technological advances that were happening at the time that we really wanted to explore what it meant to live, you know, in this time. And then, you know, with a protagonist who was a woman, who, you know, who was creative and had these ideas and, you know, what it would be like to live in that time. Because even, you know, in the 90s, in the early 2000s, there were people telling us, what are we going to do with you? You know what I mean? Can you imagine you know, what it meant for her? You know what I mean? So it was just like, and it took a long time for us to, you know, we were developing the characters and working with different artists, and it took us a little while to bring the invention of E.J. Whitaker to life, it happened, and we're so glad that it did. We were able to get it crowdfunded.
Yeah, on Kickstarter, we ended up we raised more than $10,000 than what we were.
Which we thought we would just get like 15, you know, maybe $50 from our mom, and that was it.
Yeah, but it was just amazing because the audience responds to a story like this. Like, people were like, yes, we want this, we need this. One other thing I wanted to say about researching that time period, we also discovered Ada Overton Walker, who was she was a dancer, she was a theater performer, and she was advocating for equal rights for Black women on the stage. And she wrote some pretty passionate, I mean, we look into some, researching some of the newspaper articles and stuff. She was out in New York. And she was a part of the Williams and Walker theater troupe. So these were early pioneers of African-American entertainment. But when it was time to name our character, it was like in honor of Ada Overton Walker, who actually died early. She died in like 1913. But we were like, shout out, you know, Ada's name for Ada Overton Walker. But yeah, so we know we wanted to center it at Tuskegee in Alabama, in the South. At that time, Tuskegee was a university that was built by the students. This is the incredible thing. Like, the students made the bricks. We actually took a road trip down to Tuskegee, and you just, the bricks that they, you know, they're still standing, you know, and there's photos where you can see them making the bricks. And these students were super passionate about having an institution that they built with their own hands. We knew that George Washington Carver was an instructor there during this time period. And just in terms of, you know, us dealing with themes of, you know, orphans and all of that stuff, like George Washington Carver, we wanted him to be her protector. Like, this would be her her adopted father, you know. The backstory is that Ada was left on his doorstep when she was a baby. And then we'll find out more about her origin story. But we knew that this was a safe place. And Tuskegee, we interviewed some women when we went to Tuskegee who just told us.
The archives.
Yeah, they worked in the archives, and they were just telling us, like, they went to the school in the 50s and 60s, and how this was like a Mecca. This was where, you know, this is where you wanted to be. And then, like, and then just even when we were driving around Alabama to see the, we continue to talk about DNA or whatever. You see the DNA of Booker T. Washington, Martin Luther King, just, you know, a few miles away in Montgomery, Alabama, the whole civil rights movement, you know, that spawned, you know, it started in the 1900s with progressive people at Tuskegee. And just Alabama mm-hmm. as a state, you know, like when you really dig into it, it's like, wow, like this was a movement,
the place
that has been for like a half a century was like thought was happening. People were like, you know, fighting before the civil rights fight. So we knew that this was a special place and we had to center it there. And the other thing was, we wanted to tell an adventure story that, you know, had a female protagonist, and then also had a man, you know, Black man and women like going on adventures together, which is something that we don't get to see. Like, sometimes it's like, oh, okay, a Black woman gets an adventure or a Black man gets an adventure.
There's always one without the other.
Yeah.
Like, so you get kind of plucked out of this story.
Yeah. So in terms of like building, you know, like community, male, female relationships, this is going to be, for us, E.J. Whitaker is like a unification. Like, you have a brilliant inventor and you have a brilliant businessman in William who, like, and initially you're like, can I trust him? Is he, you know, what's happening here? But he's equally brilliant. And so together, these characters will work together to, you know, to get this flying machine off the ground and save everybody in Tuskegee.
Right. Well, that's a great way to end. And it does this class over at 2, so we ran over. But I really appreciate you taking the time and answering those questions and really sort of sharing the origin story. Of course, these are going to be, you know, delving into your work. Our next essay assignment is asking to think about your work in contact with some other works, but I really appreciate you taking the time, and really excited about featuring your work in the show. So again, thank you, and good luck, and thanks for, you know, getting up early. I mean, I guess.
Oh yeah, these are our regular hours. So yeah, thank you so much. We appreciate it, and thank you for featuring us and listening to our story.
Yeah, and we wish you and your students good luck in everybody's endeavors. We thank you for the amazing questions you asked, and we wish everybody good luck. Oh, we hear that Michigan is beautiful at this time.
Oh yeah,
a coworker said, "Oh, this is the prettiest time of year down there." So we're missing out. We know we wish we could have been there.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's on the one hand, it's horrible. COVID. On the other hand, there's like the weirdness of that you can email people like, "Hey, would you come to my class?" Man, like, so for the people who are still here, if you turn on your camera, I'll take a picture so we can prove that you were. Because I know that that's That's the Tim Fielder move. We always like take the. But again, thanks so much. And
oh yeah, we can take a picture. How do you even?
You gotta do a screen.
Yeah, I'll do it through preview.
There you go.
Well, no, we'll do it some other time. All right. Well, thank you.
I'll do it for you. Hold on a second.
Oh, okay.
Alex, Catherine. The last person is Catherine. There we go. All right. Say hi. There you go.
Thank you.
I will drop this in the, I'll email this to you.
Perfect. Ooh. Cool.
All right.
Thank you very much. Okay, you guys, take care. Take it easy, everybody.